Hello, class, and welcome to the OM Podcast, Outwear's podcast all about the mobile industry. My name is Keith Smythe, and as you may have noticed, I introduced us as a class. Today, we're talking about mobile and education, and I'm joined by three special guests today, two from outside Outwear, one from inside, and I'll go around the table and have everyone introduce themselves and what they do. So,
Past viewers may remember me from a few past episodes and know that
so many letters.
I'm not so many special guests. I'm still surprised how I keep getting a return phone call to come back to these things. But yes, my name is Michael Dalich. I'm one of the business development managers here at Outwear, and I'm also a part-time master's student studying via sort of correspondence. So have some thoughts and opinions in the space.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome. Yeah, we receive literally letters just about
getting
Michael, just
airway.
Get him back on. Get that Michael back on. He says such smart things. And next on our list of guests,
Beverly Oliver, Deputy Vice Chancellor Education, Deakin University. And my particular role there is to drive the teaching and learning strategy to make sure that we offer students a brilliant education where they are and where they want to go. And I'm quoting there from our strategic agenda. So I'll happily talk about that more later.
Beverly, did you just want to sort of mention to people who aren't really familiar with the university sector and sort of how senior you actually are within the university? Because I think sometimes someone might hear your title and not actually realize that.
How really important.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Sure. Well, universities are led by vice chancellors, and vice chancellors have a raft of people to help them called deputy vice chancellors and vice presidents usually, and I'm one of those.
So you're essentially second in charge?
Sort of, yes,
okay,
I guess
good.
So, along
that's
with several other people.
Okay, great.
Sorry, no one's listening.
Yep.
And third?
G'day, Internet. I am also a big deal.
Matt's in charge of himself.
Yeah, executive. I'm a final year student at RMIT University studying software engineering. I also did my internship for a year and a half at Outwear Mobile as an Android developer. So I'm polishing off my degree now. And also, I'm one of the youngest members of staff at RMIT, course leading and head tutoring the mobile development class for RMIT explicitly.
And your name?
Matt Witherow. Sorry.
It's fine. That's it. You've passed
my name
the test.
Tag, but you
check.
Can't see that. So.
Yeah, no, we'll publish names later on. Cool, yeah. So, like I said, we're all here to talk about education, and we're going to give it a mobile spin and talk about mobile and mobile in education. Now, I have a degree, honest. It's quite a while ago when I had a degree, so I haven't stepped foot in a learning capacity into a university for quite some time. Can someone catch me up on what's been happening since 2003, I think, is when I when I graduated? Nothing. It's exactly. So what's different? What is this current state of mobile in university?
Mobile. I think what we would have to start with is actually learning.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of learning? And I think universities particularly are changing rapidly and set to change even more rapidly in the future if certain legislation happens. However, what we've been trying to do in universities, and I'm referring now across the sector, the whole of the sector, and so my colleagues here around the table will have experience of this, is to offer students the sort of education which will enable them to take the next step in their life, whether that be career, life, whatever, but also to do that in a way which is purposeful and mirrors the way we now live. So obviously, university's been very involved with online learning for a long time. And I'm interested to hear you say you're learning by correspondence. That sort of sounds to me like when we used to post out books and things,
yeah,
which is not very long ago in
some university's like a pen pal.
A little bit like that.
Yeah.
So we've been trying to go online. That, of course, means mobile. But I'm wondering, why would we talk about mobile when it's just the way you live? So I'll throw in a provocation here, and that is we often say technology describes what was invented since you were born. Now, in my case, that's quite a bit. But in your case, for example, a child who's grown up knowing there's an iPad thing there or whatever it is and you touch it and things move, that to them is not technology. That's just how you live.
Mm.
So, you know, when so much rich information is at my fingertips on my either mobile device or as of early 2015 on my Apple Watch, for example. Or
we're current.
In my camera, we are so hip and happy. Or on my laptop or whatever it is. You know, so few people use desktops these days. Sales are falling. We know all that. Mm. Do we need to keep saying mobile? I guess that's what I'm asking. Isn't it just whatever's in your pocket, whatever's on your wrist?
Yeah, in my technology. Is another word? Let's coin a phrase for it.
In my technology. But I guess it is, I mean, to sort of talk it beyond just the education sector, it is a discussion that's going on. Mm. And why do we keep discussing mobile? I guess because it hasn't perhaps crossed that threshold yet, really? In mainstream, where the debate is still desktop versus mobile, and that there still is a place in the world for both options. But I guess... The longer we go on and the more we move into the wearable sector, that counter argument of desktop still being relevant may more further and further.
I think it might be further advanced than you imagine.
Mm.
If we can put credence to the research, I was reading a report put out about 3 weeks ago by Deloitte, Australian Media Survey 2014, that shows, well, lots of interesting stuff, the way we watch TV. You know, TV is a static thing, but now most of us watch it on demand. We binge watch, for example. We multitask. And the further you go up the age bracket, the less you multitask. So if you ask a 60-year-old what they do while they're watching TV, they say, I watch TV. But of course, if you...
I sit.
Exactly. And I absolutely concentrate on the screen. If you say to a 15-year-old, well, they've probably got three devices on the go and they're doing six things. Mm. They also tell us that smartphone ownership is really, really high now and is considered to be, by the respondents that they talk to anyway, the go-to device.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe it's further than we kind of imagine.
It's interesting you say that, though. So my experience being a sort of a part-time student studying online, perhaps not via correspondence was the correct terminology,
is that
I have evenings where I have to go home and sort of get in touch with my classmates, one based in Tokyo and Japan, and, you know, that part of it is very international, but I am forced to go home to my laptop and sit in front of my laptop to do this because the tools that are being presented to me are not mobile friendly. So it seems that there is a genuine understanding that this is current, this is where it should be, but perhaps it isn't being matched with technology, at least in my experiences thus far.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
And from the other side of the fence, where we're hamstrung as universities or higher education institutions and schools as well is we're all buying large software infrastructure.
I can think of one that comes to mind straight away.
Learning management systems, for example.
Yep.
And there are about three predominant ones in this country.
Yep.
Blackboard, Moodle and Desire to Learn.
Okay, you went there.
Blackboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a dirty word to me.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the thing is, these are all very, very large enterprises.
Mm.
They're global companies. They make products, many of which are fairly well designed around the North American market, and not all of them. They are more or less immutable.
Mm.
They are fairly book-like. Mm. They are built for desktops and laptops. And, yes, the mobile platform, either Android or iPad or whatever, are sort of struggling to keep up. They're getting there, but these are not systems that work really fast. And quite frankly, this is one of the biggest challenges I have working with a large university who has a very ambitious agenda in the digital space is actually working with the software companies that we are working with. That's not to denigrate those companies, but just to say that the market is not as agile. So... you know, it's easy for designers like Google and Android and Apple to make groovy devices and consumers buy them.
Mm.
But when you have very large enterprise systems, sometimes there is a lag.
Yep.
And we are all a bit hamstrung. Plus, we are all in great competition with each other.
Sure.
So do you think the problem might come down to either these large enterprise systems that are already at the universities for them to catch up with the sort of the mobile curve, so to speak? Or is it more of something that can be solved by a more bespoke application built for different universities? As in, this is our university. We have these needs. We want it to be on iPad, Android, laptop, etc. Do you think that's a better option? Or?
Well, I do. And this, of course, gives me an entree into describing what we've done at Deakin, which is because we all have these sort of limitations, if you like. Mm. So what we've done in-house is actually come up with a bespoke solution called Deakin Sync, as in sync, your life in sync.
Very or the large, band.
Very large electronic portal, which sort of suppresses the learning management system, if you like, takes out all the features which might be a little bit distracting. So students go in there, their whole life's at their fingertips, library, order a coffee, you know, intercampus bus, what location you're on, talk to people on link, talk face-to-face, that sort of thing, plus dive straight into your unit or course inside the learning management system without having to log on separately. So we've just suppressed the features which were less interesting and more cluttered, and that, of course, is being designed for mobile as well. Mm. So that's our particular solution. Other universities will have other ways of doing
it. I've seen Deakin Sync, and I think the way it's set up and what you're trying to achieve with it is quite revolutionary in this space. I haven't seen in my learning experiences something else that copies it. I'm not saying there's nothing else out there.
Mm.
But I imagine when yourself or one of your colleagues took this idea to your executive, it would have required quite a bit of buy-in to go down that path. What did that look like for you? Perhaps if there's other organisations out there trying to pursue these goals of developing in-house bespoke pieces of software to achieve these outcomes, because the market is not listening to them otherwise. Was it a hard sell for you guys as a university to get this off the ground, or it sounds like you yourself are quite sold on mobile.
Mm.
Was that echoed amongst everyone else that had to sort of sign off with it? Okay.
Yes, I think our strategic agenda is quite clear, and I think we're quite unified as a group because what we're trying to do is design this around the user.
Mm-hmm.
And the person of most interest to me, and I would say my colleagues on the executive, is the student.
Yep.
And the staff, of course.
Yep.
But if the end user is the student, we haven't got it completely solved yet. The shell is there and it all works and it's lovely, but there are still some bits which I think are a bit clunky going from one system to another. So when we buy these learning management systems, we have a lot of branding, by the way, a lot of sub-branding. So you'll often see you log on to a university and you'll see Blackboard, or it's been rebranded as I don't know what RMIT calls it, or it might be
Blackboard.
Everywhere it's Blackboard.
It'll be Swinburne Online or whatever it is. There's a sub-brand. But when you go inside the learning management system too, there might be a virtual classroom or a peer assessment tool called Spark or a Collaborate or a virtual classroom, whatever. And so students have to navigate all these sub-brands as well because, again, we have to go to several vendors and mash it all together, and sometimes we can't actually get rid of the sub-brands. And so students have to learn a whole new language and landscape, which I think is annoying.
New ecosystem.
Although you did ask me about whether it was difficult to get buy-in for this, and the rest of that answer is no. I think that's one of the opportunities we've had is to my colleague, William Confalonieri, who's the Chief Digital Officer. We work together on this and bring one solution.
Mm-hmm.
So we've rolled this out for students now. The next rollout will be for staff, for example. So we can all have this kind of high-end electronic at your fingertips access. I mean, this is not new. Universities have been using portals for quite some time. I guess what I was trying to allude to was I think what we've done with this one is mesh the learning management system with a bespoke representation layer that actually takes the navigation pane away from the user.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to do. So, and that might be the different bit that we've done.
Just staying on the topic of sort of the management level of a university, how much time do you guys spend talking about mobility? I know, it's only one small facet of a very big institution dealing with a whole range of issues, but is it something that gets brought up often at sort of your executive level meetings, or...?
I would say not so much mobility because, again, I'll go back to my opening comment. I take that as a given.
Yeah.
We actually did a piece of research at Deakin a couple of years ago now to find out, well, really, among our students, what do they really have?
Mm.
What do they, in terms of devices, broadband, how affordable, how reliable? If we go and make all this high-end video content, for example, will they be able to access it?
Mm-hmm.
So we actually went and did that research, and we found, yes, they're like the rest of the population. They have – not everyone has everything, of course, and not everyone can afford everything, but most people have most of what they need. So We know that the mobility of the devices is very high. Laptops, pretty well ubiquitous. Smartphones, you know, which one will it, do you want me to tell you about? I've got two or three. Yeah. That's, you know, sometimes we get that answer. Yeah.
We have about 50 here.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, you win. And then, so we know that's what our students have got. So we don't focus so much on mobility. We take it as a given. Yep. But we do focus on the seamless, elegant digital user experience for the student on the campus and in the cloud. Mm. So, and that's what we call it at Deakin, is cloud learning. We want to talk about the cloud, not online, because online is sometimes a book on a screen and that's really easy to do, but it's a really awful experience.
Yep.
So we think if you're going to be learning online, you should be talking face-to-face on the screen in real time over high-end video using, you know, Skype, Link, Facebook call, not Facebook, FaceTime, whatever is at your fingertips. So we think that that's the challenge, because if that's the way we live, that's our mantra. If that's the way our students live, that's the way we live, that's the way we should be learning.
Yep.
That's our challenge, you know, to make it as elegant and seamless as the ANZ app or I know that's a really
–
that's a minor example, but it's very elegant and it works, you know, it just works.
You should be doing like the Apple keynote speaker talk.
Yeah,
talk about all your user experience.
And should we dub it over with a Chinese translation at the start? I heard they had a summer.
Yeah,
you had to be there.
that AIM can be very difficult at the ground level as well. Maybe a little bit of backstory. I was surprised when Dalek said you don't consider yourself a correspondence student. So I did correspondence for my first year of uni when I was actually at Monash, and I live in the middle of nowhere. I probably know more about beef cattle than any other software engineer in the country. And
it's a good niche.
Yeah, it's a great niche, actually. Yeah.
Really good combination.
Very good niche. And when I was growing up, we didn't have any internet. Or, I mean, I went to a primary school of 30 kids. And the problem out in a rural area of Australia like that is you've only got a very limited number of higher education, or not even higher education, high schools. So, for a very large geographical area. So, you've got two or three high schools that can cater to an entire region. So, you have a very broad window when you're talking about the demographic of your students, social economic upbringing and all that. So, to say on the ground level, we're going to give iPads to all the students and we're going to try and build a sort of cloud infrastructure. Australia's infrastructure is a whole nother podcast. But really being able to say, look, can every parent of every child in this rural school afford that kind of, you know, upfront cost, or can we maintain it over a long period and can we scale it to a large number, is very difficult, as well as providing like the actual software. Mm-hmm. Being pragmatic about it can be very difficult as well. So, in terms of mobility, when I was a correspondence student, mobility for me was driving 3.5 hours through torrential floodwaters to get to the nearest Monash campus to do my exams. And I ended up forking out about $8,000 with a government grant to get a satellite dish so that I could access Moodle.
Oh my gosh.
To submit an assignment.
You're going to be one of those. I was going to say, you're going to be one of those grandpas that has the story. Back in my day, I used to drive through torrential floodwaters to get in.
I had a 16,000 ping rate.
To be fair, though, and I'm not downplaying
your story. I am an extreme case.
Yeah, you are an extreme case, but there are many extreme cases, but they are a very small percentage.
Mm.
And we do have, I believe, the obligation to enable that kind of access to every person in this country, no matter where they are. And so we'll save the broadband, national broadband sort of discussion for another day, shall we?
Yeah. But stay tuned for the NBN discussion.
Yeah, exactly. Count me out that day. Yeah. However, you see, I think educational institutions in this country, and we're going primary, secondary, tertiary, whatever, we all have an obligation to make the big pipe, I'll call it that, the big Arnet pipe, a pipe, as accessible to our students as possible. Even if we enable, you know, remote country areas, and we're working in a few of those now, and I know other universities are as well, where you actually do have a learning centre in a regional town like Swan Hill, Portland, you know, other places like this.
Western Australia.
Leingatha, shout out.
Well, speaking of which, Widgiemooltha, those sorts of places, yes. There are ways of actually getting access to that point, and then for the rural person, they may be able to, you said you drove 3 hours to get to your campus and so on. These are the challenges we have to meet, but I don't think we can sit and say, oh, well, I can't guarantee every single bit of this to every single person, so I can't do anything. Because we have to design for the 97%, I think, and then figure out how we're going to solve it for that 3%.
It's interesting you mentioned that Deakin is moving towards this cloud learning solution. How much of that was on the agenda and happening in the pipeline versus how much of that has been expedited because of things like MOOCs and, you know, online learning courses and other businesses like Open Universities coming into the fray? Did they force universities to sort of go, well, we have to have this out quicker? Or was that just, you know, naturally evolving?
It was naturally evolving. So universities have been doing online learning since the mid-90s. We had a discussion before we started broadcasting about me doing my PhD in the late 90s. Yeah. As I mentioned, late last century, I was pioneering in online learning.
Well, you're still a doctor this century. So
yeah, I am. Yeah. And it was on dial-up and it was really, really bad. Yeah. But anyway, that was the early days. Yeah. And yes, it's a really interesting concept that some things can be made available in a much more flexible format, and that's where we started with online learning. However, universities have across the world have been on this agenda. There's a whole research literature around what is really good learning, how can another form, another medium make that more accessible, more engaging, more effective, and so on. Deakin certainly was well and truly down this path when I joined it 3 years ago. It's got 40 years of experience in distance education, by the way. And, you know, at Swinburne Online, the one you mentioned, that was a deal done. That partnership with Seek Learning was done a couple of years ago. That wasn't as a result of MOOCs. The funny thing that happened when MOOCs came along was...
Did you want to perhaps maybe explain what a MOOC is for people who don't know?
A MOOC is a massive open online course. So if I translate that for you, it's an online unit or part of a degree that a university puts out for free. That's about it.
Yep.
So it's not as big a deal, I think, as a lot of people make it out to be. I guess my reflection on the MOOC, the open free course, is that many of them are simply doing the same model of teaching and learning that universities have done for centuries. Now, I'm going to exaggerate here, but just to make my point. So traditional teaching and learning in a university is a person stands at the front of a very large room. They talk to many people at once. That's called a lecture. That's a broadcast. It's captured somehow. It's often nowadays really jazzy because it's got like PowerPoint slides with it. We can describe it sometimes as PowerPoint karaoke.
Yep.
We put the slides up, we talk to the slides. But that's an expectation now, and you know that came in the late 90s. We sometimes capture and broadcast those events now. We call them iLecture or other names around the sector.
Yep.
And that's an expectation. Students want to be able to access that flexibly, whether it's pictures, voice, face, whatever. So we were doing all of that sort of stuff, and a lot of MOOCs simply are putting that kind of teaching and learning on steroids, if you like, by dressing it up, spending quite a bit of money on it because, every course at Deakin, of course, doesn't need to be dressed up, but I believe that other universities, you know, need a bit of work. No, of course, you want your free open course to look fabulous.
Amazing and impressive.
Absolutely. Yep. So a lot of the MOOC movement around the world sort of gave people the impression, oh, my God, there's this whole thing called online learning, you know. Yes, well, we've been down this path a very long time. I guess the thing that made the difference is because a whole pile of things happened at the same time. So, for example, Khan Academy was starting to gather publicity, but also players like Harvard, Stanford, the Ivy Leagues, you know, they started doing this, which started making the other, I guess we could say, presidents, vice chancellors around the world much more aware. So there's a whole movement in the UK, FutureLearn, which is the UK platform for MOOCs with open universities and British Museum and all sorts of things. To me, it's not about making yesterday's teaching model a bit like a TV broadcast with steroids. It's not about just making that available, open and free to the masses. It's about pushing the boundary. So if I go back to the ANZ app, we can offer a student a brilliant education which is seamless, elegant, and really engaging, and so that students are actually achieving the real sort of learning outcomes they need to achieve, and not just amassing marks and grades and credits, for example, mm-hmm. which I know you have some thoughts about, Matt.
Yeah, I think the Australian education system for higher education, at least, is maybe a little bit geared towards the motto, peace, get degrees, because a lot of students come from a competitive learning environment where they're bell-curved, but when you get to university, a pass can be a pass and everyone gets a degree at the end of the day. And I find that as a teacher, it definitely splits students into two categories, those who use university as a springboard to do excellently and take it as kind of just the start of their education. They kind of do a lot of stuff outside of mandatory hours, and those who do the minimum to get the qualification. And I think what mobile can maybe provide to that space is personification. Is that a word?
Personalization.
I'm going to run with it. Personalization, personification of education. And yeah, it's going to help us get around the entire broadcasting. Well, education and broadcasting, like you were saying, a lecture is 1 to 200 or 1 to 500. So it's very difficult to, I guess, tailor an education to a cohort of students. You don't have any knowledge about where they're at or what they would like to know. So it's a very difficult model to be effective. One I affectionately call the cookie cutter model.
I think it's also because our traditional form of teaching in universities is very knowledge focused. We teach knowledge. We transmit knowledge, if you like. And the other agenda that's been chugging alongside this for the last 15 years around all Australian universities is a focus on graduate attributes or capabilities or learning outcomes. And that's coming much more to the fore. So I'm going to head here to digital badging, if that's interesting.
Yep.
So what we want to do at Deakin, and I know,
gamification, so that's
sort of a bit of gamification. Yeah. What we want to do with digital learning at Deakin is use it wherever it solves learning challenges, wherever it makes learning more effective, efficient, engaging, or accessible, or all of the above, preferably. So I'm going to go back to Matt's point about marks and grades, and we traditionally offer a degree broken up into, say, 24 units or courses, whatever we call them. And the game we play, we as students, is that we enrol, usually using a magic number called an ATAR or something like that, which actually doesn't tell you a lot about what's underneath. What can the student really do and what can't they do? Well, it's hard to tell because
it shows they're really good at exams.
That's exactly right. And the game we learn is how to make marks, how to gather marks. And this game is not entirely broken, but it's a little bit broken. So what we want to do in our curriculum at Deakin is make sure that we build in learning evidence against all the graduate capabilities that we think are important for career and life and employability and so on. So to be more specific, not just about knowledge, say software engineering, but what are the communication skills as a graduate you will require? The team skills, the problem solving, the critical thinking, global citizenship, all what I call the usual suspects, the generic learning outcomes. So we want to actually try, and we haven't done it yet, but we're in conversation about it, is to use digital badging not to gamify this so much, but to warrant. So Matt, if you were my student and I saw you demonstrate the required outcome and standard of communication skills for a new software engineer, I would give you the digital token called a digital badge, which would be my warrant as an accredited assessor to you, a student. I have seen you do this. Here's the warrant.
It's like Cub Scouts.
A little bit, except it's more than Cub Scouts because behind the digital badge, there's metadata and evidence. So anyone in the world would be able to see what you did to demonstrate that learning. So it's not just like the Scout badge or the...
So it's a bit more like on LinkedIn when someone can endorse a skill.
Yeah, with some evidence behind it, by the way.
But the random person who just added you on the weekend.
Someone with authority can endorse your skill.
I don't want to shoot myself down, but I am not that good at JavaScript. Yeah. Everyone's trolling my LinkedIn by just upvoting me on JavaScript.
Yeah, upvote Matt Witherow. We're all telling him he's
very
good at JavaScript.
Here comes 4,000 upvotes. Fantastic.
We don't have that many people.
I think the badging idea is really good to give a little bit of granularity to how I can split my students. I feel like students are very acutely aware that, you know, the final outcome of their degree or their class is heavily based on numerics and the grades that they get. And like I said, it's very, they get very good at reverse engineering exams so that they can get those marks. But what I want a student to feel like, what warrants their success in their degree or even just that one course for the semester, is how confident they are about the material, not what the letter was that they got back at the end of the semester.
And how they can articulate that.
Yeah.
And how they can present themselves with confidence. Exactly right, I believe.
Yeah, it's more of not just knowing the answer, it's knowing how to get to the answer.
Yes, exactly.
And knowing the theory around it and why.
How to convince a potential employer that you actually can get the answer or question the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's the employability. I would call those the broader graduate capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of interviews here for new developers and things. So I get to talk to a lot of people who've been through universities. And it's, I always tell anyone, even if you've been developing for 10 years or something like that, I always tell them, it's not about getting the right answer. It's about the conversation around it. Mm. It's, I more want to hear your thought process than have you just arrive directly at the right answer.
Mm.
I mean, it's always impressive if someone immediately does it, but then you think, are you cheating? Yeah.
Do you think this badgifying approach would be able to start answering some of those questions, being able to give someone some credence for being able to, you know, discuss an answer rather than, you know, just present a paper or something like that?
I don't think there's any silver bullet.
Okay.
So I don't think it's going to solve the problem, but I hope it might shift the conversation.
Mm.
So I think as universities, we're very good at teaching units, giving marks, grades, credits. That's what we do.
Mm.
But we need to shift the conversation and shift the student mindset, if I could say, and also remind the student that it's not just about the big badge called the degree and the marks and grades that appear on it. That's just your entry ticket to get to the table.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So the badge might be a mechanism. Even if an employer never saw the badges, and I don't know that employers ever should, maybe they're personal reminders. It's like you talked about, personalisation.
Yep.
Because if there are, say, 8 big outcomes that I need to achieve, like the communication skills and all that, and I have a set of badges that reminds me, oh, I've got heaps against those ones, but there's nothing against those. So, oh, message to self, must do something about this, because the industry is telling me, employers are telling me, my teachers are telling me, if you want to be successful in life, along with the badge called the degree, you need these things and you need evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about actually getting – so we're trying lots of strategies like this. We're also just starting to – offer our students a free service called Me in a Minute.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Matt, particularly dealing with students. But it's about getting the student to get this message across as well. So we're offering at the moment to give our students the facility to make a one-minute video called Me in a Minute.
Mm.
We ask them to pick out 3 or 4 of our graduate outcomes, the 8 that I mentioned, pick out 3 or 4, talk on screen, for 1 minute. The icons appear about which ones they talk about, and they say, oh, well, I'm good at this, this is because, and here's my evidence, and blah, blah, blah. So it's like an elevator pitch to a potential employer, because it makes them start to think, you know, halfway through their degree, towards the end of their degree, I'm going to have to be able to convince someone that I can do these things, and I need to have the evidence at front of mind. Now, that's not going to change the world either, but it might be another strategy. All of these things together, which make it more front of mind for the student to be able to sell themselves in the employability stakes. Because in the environment we're heading into, I think things are going to get tighter and harder. I think it's likely higher education will become more expensive. It's more of an investment.
Mm.
Students want return.
Mm-hmm.
And so does the community. We all do.
This might be a question that sort of goes without saying and doesn't need to be discussed, but in terms of where industry is heading in the future, and I know you're not the sort of dean of the faculty of engineering and IT, but
thank goodness.
is software engineering, IT, more relevant today than ever before? Is it something that Deakin, I know, I believe it's not traditionally the most famous curriculum that you do teach there, you know?
Mm.
Is it something that you try to put more emphasis on, or just sort of balance it along with all your other courses and try to have a, you know, I know you want to have a consistent curriculum across the board in terms of quality, but is it something that you see and think this is a discipline of the future, we need some emphasis placed on this?
Absolutely. I think it's all of the things you mentioned. As you did say, I'm not the dean of the faculty, so I won't speak on behalf of the faculty, but I know it is a strategic emphasis because it is the way of the future. And But also, even if I go back to those eight learning outcomes, for us, digital literacy is one of them.
Yeah.
It's got to be in every course.
Mm. Yeah.
So even if it's, it could be in hardcore software engineering, but it could be in the creative arts, it could be in business, whatever it is, the student, these are, this is the electricity and the running water of the future. It's not, you know, it's been like being able to write with a biro 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I'm not sure you still need to write with a biro, but you certainly need to be able to type.
I still do it a lot.
I still have my pen license, so I haven't lost that one.
Frame that one. I think I'm a pretty hardcore advocate, actually, for getting technology into, like, core teaching. So, I don't know, I kind of ran with a crowd in Melbourne, and we were based around getting high school kids interested in software engineering. So I'm not talking about digital literacy, which I think is a good idea, but I'm talking about, like, let's get kids coding at a high school level. And there is movement already through Australia. I don't know where they're at with legislation, but hey, let's get programming in as a possible core elective or an elective at least in high school education. And it's a modern world. I can't see how it's any less relevant than learning a foreign language. Like, I learned Japanese in high school. I don't see why I couldn't have learned Python. Or, you know, they teach cooking as a high school, you know, elective, and I can code a lot more things than I can cook. So it's probably
maybe
not
that's
hard.
Yeah, finally have a good girlfriend.
Yeah, okay. Great girlfriend. Shout out. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it should be something that everybody learns in high school or even before in primary school? I remember being in primary school, and doing the... I'm showing my age a bit. We did Logo. It was the little turtle.
Okay.
You had to teach. Yeah. You taught him how to drive around.
Yep.
And I didn't even understand that it was programming at the time. I was just making a turtle draw funny
and
shapes.
Here you are.
And here I am.
Lead developer.
Where is that turtle now? That's what I'd like to
know. He's still sitting there on that old guy, just in his endless loop of circles that I forgot to break.
Or a
poor little guy.
Beverly, is there some things happening in the industry that you're looking at going, wow, that's I know that Deakin's doing quite a few innovative things, and you're sort of on the trying to be on that bleeding cutting edge.
Here we are.
Within reason.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some other things that you're seeing in the worldwide scale that you go, wow, that's really cool, we'd like to incorporate that, or, you know, test that out? Is there anything that you're not trying now that you that's impressing you within the mobility digital space?
Well, I keep going back to the mantra that I said before, we'll try anything.
Yeah.
Well, let me preface this by saying gadgets for the sake of gadgets are not our core business.
Yep.
Right. So bright, shiny things, although I'm thinking very hard how I can work an Apple Watch into my, you know, daily job. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Again, I just saw that announcement today.
I can talk your ear off about Android Wear.
I bet. Sure. Anyway, no, seriously, I don't think it's about the gadget.
Yep.
It's about really good learning and giving graduates what they need, and you can't do it without whatever the tools are.
Mm.
I think there are some amazing frontiers. We are investigating and currently talking about engaging. I can't make any announcements today, but listen carefully.
Next
watch
podcast.
This space.
It's all right. We're not recording, honestly.
So, yes, we are trying to push the frontier. If I go back to your previous question, MOOC, pretty boring.
Yep.
Really? It's a free open online course. We've been doing online courses for ages. That's not tomorrow. Tomorrow is actually talking, you know, Matt, if we go back to your life, much closer to beef cattle than we are now, you know, if you can speak face-to-face in real time with your pals around the world, you know, learn in a group, engage with a really good teacher, because that's what it's all about. It's a very human relationship. You're teaching now, so you know what it's all about. The gold of teaching and learning is all about engaging with another person who believes you can actually achieve something. They can provide you with opportunities to make evidence of your achievements. That's a long-winded description of assessment, in my view. And they can help you move forward in your life. If you can do that on a screen, and it's so good, you've forgotten the screen is there. That's really good learning.
So as a slight extension to that, what is your university of 2040? What's it look like?
Holograms. It's interesting. Well, holograms, you think?
No one knows what's going to happen. You know,
I'm just thinking of that Simpsons episode where they had the, was it Troy McClure, I think, doing the teaching to all the schools, and it was sponsored by Pepsi. if I had five apples and I lost three apples, how many? I've had five Pepsis and I lost three Pepsis. How many Pepsis do I have? And then everybody was on this one big video link all at once, and he asks some child in some random school somewhere. But it's one teacher preaching out to the 100 students or 100 schools. Let's hope that's just what I think of.
Trick question. Drink Pepsi Max.
Partial credit.
Yeah.
Do you have a vision of what you think education will look like in the higher education area in 20 years, 25 years?
Obviously, I don't know.
Yeah.
We've got some interesting things on the agenda at the moment, and I don't really want to get into those because they're all the subject of legislation at the moment. Mm. But, you know, higher education's changing very rapidly. Mm. I think industry's changing very rapidly, industry expectations. Mm. Who says you need to go to a university to be a software engineer?
Mm. That is a hot debate.
Yeah.
Mm. It is a hot debate.
Is it the best place to go?
Mm.
Or, you know,
the
should...
that way.
Yeah. I'm undecided about that still. Because I'm right in the... I'm in, like, the last 6 weeks of my degree now. Mm. And in retrospect, I don't know if it would have been. But... It's my foot in the door always. That's just how life is. The piece of paper gets me the interview in the first place. But I'm undecided, yet I can always pick software engineers out of a lineup of those who had formal education and those who didn't.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
I guess it's a difference between having someone over your shoulder who is at least some voice of authority or reason to say what you're learning is right or what you're learning is wrong. It's easy when you're in your own free domain to teach yourself something that's actually not technically correct, and there's no one there to ever kind of validate that for you. So
it works, but it's not the best way it could be.
Yeah, exactly. And then you fool yourself and you're like, this is how it gets done, and you convince yourself. And if that trickles on for, you know, many years, it leads to quite a large disconnect.
Have you ever heard of a young man called Dale J. Stevens?
No.
He's an American guy.
Okay.
I met him a couple of years ago at a conference. He spoke. And he started this movement in America called UnCollege. As you do. UnCollege. He's written books and stuff. And he's about your age. And his premise is that you're better off, particularly in some fields and particularly in IT-related fields, not going to college or university. You'll get yesterday's curriculum.
Mm.
And you're much better off not just learning it by yourself, which, okay, you could do that, but to go straight to industry and actually work at, some software
somewhere.
Company.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't be actually learning unmonitored because you would have a mentor. It would be more the apprenticeship model because you would be learning actually at the chalk face.
I think there's a big thing about software development, though, is if you want to learn how to write a program and if you're self-teaching and you don't have any background on it, you go straight into learning syntax and code and how to write a program. And what I found doing computer science was it teaches you the fundamentals.
Yep.
The first thing you do is you learn the different parts of a computer and how it all talks together. So you understand that if you're loading things into memory, it's going to be accessed much quicker by the processor than straight onto a hard drive. So universities force you to learn the fundamentals, and you learn Big O and efficiency and things like that. I mean, we have an online sort of hacker rank tool I do a lot of interviews. So I guess that's my input into this. And the amount of people brute forcing the answers that we're asking is astonishing. It's about 98% of people will try and brute force an answer instead of trying to find something much more efficient. So when we throw the test case at them that has 300,000 variables and it times out on the test case, we know that they've brute forced immediately before even looking.
Are they all trying that because that is something that they've been taught to try in a university, or that's just their instinct kicking in that that's how they think it should be done?
I think a university, if it's doing its job well, from my opinion, is they should teach students what the different tools are, like the basics of what's happening.
Mm.
And what the different tools are to help you get your problem solved. If you know very, very basic programming, I know what a for loop is, I know what a while loop is, and I can break these loops when I want to. I can brute force. Sorry?
I'm glad you know.
I'm nodding.
What loops? Yeah.
Oh, it's just iterative. I can brute force any problem and I can solve it. But as soon as that problem gets huge, and this is where you enter the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons of the world, they solve huge problems. And without those good fundamentals behind them, they can't solve those huge problems. They'll just try and brute force it and things will time out and break. And Yeah, it's, you know, you've got the battery problem where computers and mobile phones and everything need to run much more efficiently now because our phones are getting much more powerful, but our batteries seem to be getting smaller for some reason.
I think
if we draw an analogy with that, what you're saying then is, Matt, you talked before about learning Japanese. So it's like doing a course in Japanese before you land in the middle of Japan and try and figure out what on earth people are saying.
Yeah, even like the history of Japan and how they got here and things like that. Mm.
To me, it all boils down to appreciation. If someone has done those formal units, that person appreciates the technology.
Hmm.
That's, you're saying like, oh, the student's just going to brute force this solution, and like the lingo brute force is, let's just try every exhaustive option until we find a solution. Mm. They don't appreciate that that is an expensive process. Mm-hmm. Like, for a piece of text to go from my laptop to your laptop, like, that's gone through space. Right? And it's gone through decades and decades of people's lives, of mathematicians, of physicists, of astrophysicists, to get that data from one place to another and render on a pretty red screen. Like, it's... And if they don't have that formal education, they can lack that appreciation. Mm-hmm. And... as you said, the hardware just keeps getting better and better, so they just keep living their lives, brute forcing everything, and the hardware is just kind of helping them along. So,
Yeah, we need people that could solve big problems.
Yeah, you need to be able to think decisively.
Critically, in the context of the discipline.
Yes.
I think that's what
you're
saying.
Yeah, so this is completely applicable to software engineering, but across all standard educations, I think you need to have that appreciation.
If we want to use an analogy that's outside of the sphere, I did Mandarin during university.
Ni hao.
But when I landed in China, I still couldn't count to 10.
Yi, er, san, si, wu, liu, qi, ba, jiu.
Jiu ba shu.
Jiu ba shu.
Close, but this is not a Mandarin-speaking podcast. There's very good ones out there. But it was that fundamental understanding of how to... an appreciation of the language and a few of the fundamentals that then allowed you to pick it up pretty quickly.
Mm.
So I think that's an analogy that's outside of the software sphere.
But you also mentioned culture, I think.
Yeah.
Or you did. You know, it's about actually knowing the history and how... it's not just knowing the words, it's knowing the intonation, the expression, how to deal with people.
Correct. Building that appreciation.
I guess that's what you're telling us, why IT is needed in the formal curriculum. I'm very happy to hear this, of course, because I don't think un-college is a great way to go. Mm. But... it's very reassuring to hear that we do need the fundamental in education integrated wherever possible with industry and informed by industry. I guess that's the tension we live with.
Mm. I mean, it comes down to, it's a hard thing to learn, so you need the most help to learn it.
Mm.
Yeah. I think we can wrap up on that. I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much to our lovely guests for joining, and to Michael as well. Thank you, Luz, for making sure that the laptop runs while we're recording, and to Andy, who left. Cool. Join us next time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Gracias.